I mean, I'll know when we're all inside.
No, you're not goddamn going. Show us on the blueprints.
I can't. My blueprint was in my head. I was underground for 3 days in the dark, just waiting for the tides to be right. But don't worry, it'll all come back to me.
You're not going anywhere, Mason.
Wait a second. Now, this piece of work might be the only chance those people over there have. If he's not going, then why the hell did we get him out of jail?
He's smart.
I got him out to get you people in, not go with you.
If it's the only way of getting the intelligence I need, then he goes.
He'll fuck with you.
You compromise my men's lives, and I'll bury you out there.
Womack, you're between the rock and a hard case. How's your bowling arm?
I'm Mark.
And I'm Ben.
And this week we are covering The Rock from 1996. Now, Ben decided he wanted to cover this one, and I agree completely. This is a fun film to watch.
Well, I mean, everybody deserves the right and the opportunity to watch the documentary about Dwayne Johnson. No, or did I watch? Or did I watch the wrong movie?
I think it did.
Oh,
jeez.
Damn it!
Oh, man, Nicolas Cage, man. Sean Connery. Come on, man!
Oh, all right. I got to come back in a couple hours. Then I thought we were talking about Young Rock on NBC.
Yeah. Cut to 2 hours later.
Yeah. Exactly. No, I knew exactly what movie we were doing.
So with that, we're covering The Rock 1996 with Sean Connery and Nicolas Cage. So the synopsis for this particular movie is FBI chemical warfare expert Stanley Godspeed, I always say that, but Nicolas Cage is sent on an urgent mission with former British spy John Patrick Mason, played by Sean Connery, to stop General Francis Hummel, played by Ed Harris, and from launching a chemical weapons on Alcatraz Island into San Francisco. So General Hummel demands $100 million in war reparations to be paid to the families of slain servicemen who died on covert operations. After their SEAL team is wiped out, Stanley and John deal with the soldiers on their own.
And they live happily
ever after.
Now you don't need to watch the movie because the synopsis just gave it all away.
Not necessarily, but you get all that cool stuff in between.
If that synopsis doesn't sell you on the film, I don't know what will.
Exactly. But with this movie, we get people that we have seen before in other films. So I'll start off. Well, we have Claire Forlani, and she was in Mallrats, which was her first big break with Kevin Smith with his trifecta of the Jersey movies that he did with Clerks, Mallrats, and Chasing Amy. And then she went on to do Meet Joe Black with Anthony Hopkins and Brad Pitt. And do Mystery Men with
Ben Stiller.
Yes.
William H. Macy, Paul Rubens.
Yes.
I forget his last name. Keenan from Keenan and Kel.
Yes.
I forget Kel's last name.
Yeah. But that's an interesting movie. We should really cover that on Panels to Pixels.
Mystery Men is a fun movie.
It's a fun movie to do. So
I can't feel my ass. I can't feel my ass.
then we have Tony Todd, the Candyman himself, and he was in the TV show The Flash.
The voice of Zoom,
exactly. You covered that on DC Primetime.
Indeed.
And he was also in the movie The Crow with Brandon Lee. And so much more. Tony has had such an amazing career with being just like a character actor in many films and movies. I think a lot of people remember him. Probably this generation will probably remember him from the disaster movies. I forget the name of it, right now.
Oh, the Butterfly Effect. No. Sorry, not Butterfly Effect. Final Destination.
Exactly.
Yes.
So, you know,
I'll see you soon.
So,
can you tell I quote movies a lot?
Of course. Everybody knows that right now.
If you've heard me on this podcast or other podcasts, you know.
Yeah.
I live my life through movie quotes.
And he could actually have conversations with movie quotes, ladies and gentlemen. Trust me.
I have. I've done it.
Next up would be Ed Harris. And as we've mentioned before, that Ed was in The Abyss with, you know, when Diana and I covered that back in, I'm forgetting which episode of Adrenaline Cinema Podcast, but we covered that, The Abyss, before. And Ed plays the opposite role of Michael Biehn in this particular movie in comparison, where and Michael Biehn played the antagonist in The Abyss and Ed Harris played the protagonist. Now it's kind of vice versa. So that's pretty cool. And we also know him from The Right Stuff, The Truman Show, George Romero's Knight Riders, and so much more. And then we have Ben. Who else?
So William Forsythe is next up on the list, who you and I were actually just discussing before we started recording.
Exactly.
Raising Arizona, which is another Nicolas Cage movie, Rob Zombie's Halloween, Devil's Rejects, Deuce Bigelow, Male Gigolo, Flat Top and Dick Tracy. He's been in a ton of stuff.
Yes.
He is a very well-known character actor. But followed by David Morse, who is on the list as well, who I'm glad I get to talk about because he is a Philly guy.
Yes, he is.
Just like me. Regular cast member on Say It Elsewhere for years before he ventured into movies such as 12 Monkeys, Green Mile, Contact, World War Z, and The Hurt Locker.
And then we have Xander Berkeley, who we know him as Gregory from The Walking Dead, or everybody else in the world will know from Terminator 2 as the deadbeat stepfather to John Connor.
Another Terminator alum in this movie.
Exactly. So I thought it was a small role, but it's pretty funny that we get him for such a small cameo, just doing a bit part in the very beginning at the time when Stanley is trying to take care of the bomb in the very beginning of the movie. And yeah. I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah. John Spencer, who mostly known for... See, I'm going to correct you on this one.
Okay.
Mostly known for TV show L.A. Law. I would change that to The West Wing.
Okay. Yeah, he was in The West Wing, too. Yeah.
And that's actually one of his final roles because he passed away in the midst of The West Wing.
Yes, he did.
But yeah, movie credits are also War Games, Sea of Love, Black Rain, Presumed Innocent, The Negotiator, and Ravenous.
Yeah. And then we got Danny Nucci, who you may remember him from Titanic with Leonardo DiCaprio's, you know, being his friend to Jack, trying to get onto the Titanic. He had that accent. So, yeah, it's how they played cards to get on. He was also in the movie Alive and Crimson Tide. And he makes actually a very good military guy in this particular movie, I thought.
Remind me, who is he? Because I'm not completely familiar, and I'm actually looking through the IMDb. Let me take a look at his face, because he is not an actor. Never mind. Know who he is.
Now you know.
Yep.
Yep.
All I had to do was see his face.
Yeah, he gives the whole speech to Stanley about, it's like, what are we doing, sir? And then, Lieutenant, and he just gives him, rattles off the speech of, like, what their mission is. And that's like the best part.
He's like the young guy in the group that actually Mason and Goodspeed tried to save his life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He runs back in and they're telling him, no, don't go. And he does.
Yeah, exactly. Gregory Sporletter, who you would know from Twister, Renaissance Man, and the 2010 version of The Crazies.
Yes. And then we got John C. McGinley, known for his role as Dr. Perry Cox.
Wrong.
Okay, what was
No, no, no. I was quoting Dr. Cox. Sorry.
I was playing off that.
I was quoting a Scrubs line from Dr. Cox. Continue.
Yeah, but he was in Scrubs as Dr. Cox, as Ben pointed that out. So, but he's also known in great film roles as within Point Break. In 1991, the 1991 version, everybody, not the really
not the
bad,
remake,
not the remake,
no.
The movie Seven and Platoon too. So he was very young when he did Platoon.
And another favorite of mine, Wild Hogs.
Oh,
with,
yes.
With John Travolta, William H. Macy, Martin Lawrence, and Tim Allen.
Yeah, that was a good, funny movie.
He's the homosexual police officer that follows him and tries to skinny dip with them. it's a hysterical role.
He has comedic chops as well as drama chops as well. Yeah. It's amazing what these guys could do.
Yeah, he's another fantastic actor.
Then we have Michael Biehn. He's been mentioned before in this particular podcast so many times. Aliens, The Terminator, the grindhouse film, Planet Terror, Tombstone. And
most recently, The Mandalorian.
Yes. So, yeah, he's legendary with his name himself. So we all know his name.
Yeah. But I think that leads us to the two main men.
Exactly.
Themselves. We've got 007 himself, Sean Connery. James Bond, Ramirez from Highlander, The Hunt for Red October, Dragonheart.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man, so many great movies from Sean Connery. I'm so happy he actually retired instead of, like, not letting his career fizzle out.
Well, he retired after the League of Extremely...
League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's because... And I mean... He turned down Gandalf in The Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
To do The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. And we see how well that turned out.
Exactly.
So, yeah, when you make a poor career choice like that, probably best to just, like, ride off into the sunset. But I love Connery. I absolutely adore
Same him. Here. Yeah, as much as... Personally, he had a lot of issues with women and how he treated them. But as far as his acting chops and how he presented characters, he was amazing.
He was the man now, dog.
Yep. And then we have Nicolas Cage, and you and I both know, Raising Arizona, Face Off, Con Air, which you and I both covered,
mm-hmm.
and most recently, Willy's Wonderland.
Of course you threw Willy's Wonderland in there. Of course you did.
And so much more.
That is like one of your new favorite movies.
It is.
It's Willy's Wonderland. So of course you threw that in there. Oh, I'm not surprised.
Of course. So with that, we're going to move on to general thoughts of the movie. So Ben, why don't you start off with your general thoughts overall?
This is a movie that is like, I was on your very first episode when we talked about Die Hard.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I said at that point that Die Hard is the benchmark. Like, it is the it is the movie I compare all other movies to.
Correct.
If Die Hard didn't fill that spot, The Rock would.
Wow.
It is one of my all-time favorite action movies ever. And that says a lot, considering it is a movie with a lot, and I mean a lot, of movie mistakes. From production movie mistakes to factual mistakes, this movie is riddled with mistakes.
Oh, yeah.
I love it all the same. I don't care. Those mistakes will never make me love this movie any less.
It's a movie packed full of, like, fun within it, if you think about it. Even though it's, like, very dramatic, but we have fun with it in the sense of, like, get that pure... sense of comedy mixed with action. And that's something you don't really get to see too much with Connery all that much.
And this is also back during the heyday. Like, I have a lot of problems with Michael Bay now. But this is back during the heyday when you got Don Simpson, Jerry Bruckheimer, and Michael Bay together.
Mm.
You had movie gold.
Definitely.
You know, back before... Don Simpson passed away, and they were still a partnership between Bruckheimer and Simpson,
mm-hmm.
And Michael Bay. I mean, there are explosions galore in this movie.
Oh, yes.
Especially, there are particular times where, when you first see this movie, you're like, okay, like, explosions, this is awesome, what is this going on? And then, as you learn about film, and you watch, and you start to, like, analyze and appreciate, you watch this movie, and you're like, why was there an explosion there? Like, what happened? Like,
why did the trolley guy have to get pulled over?
No, not even that. Why did the... So the trolley runs into a car, and I was going to bring this up anyway. The trolley runs into a car, and that car produces enough explosion to lift the trolley.
Exactly.
10 feet in the air?
But it's electric.
Like, well, no, I mean, it's the car that produced the explosion. But even still, there's that car would not explode, for one. Two, there is nothing. There is no kind of an explosion from the car that would lift that trolley 10 feet in the air evenly.
I know that.
It would be like the end of the trolley that hit the car. It would send it, like, vertical. It would not lift it evenly. Like, there's so many mistakes.
It's pure movie magic. That's all it is.
I absolutely love it.
And to lead to my general thoughts, I would say I really enjoyed this movie when I saw it in the theaters. I actually did pay a ticket to go see this in the theaters.
I did, too.
And I still do love to watch this on occasion because, you know, it's one of those movies you just have to watch because of the action, the funny puns. This has so many quotes in it, too. That you just have to love to watch.
Absolutely quotable movie.
And it's one of my go-to movies that I have to laugh at that has action and both the intense humor in it within both sides. So that's all I got.
I know it's skipping ahead, but I can't wait till we get to the quote section of this episode.
Oh, I know that.
There
are
so many. And I am not apologizing. I'm putting it out there right now. I am not apologizing for bad Sean Connery impression.
It's fine.
I will not apologize for it. From either one of us. From either one of us, I will not apologize.
Of course you are.
You have to know. It's so funny because I told you before we started recording that I have no notes. Like, I'm going off the top of my head for this. And my whole intention was to at some point in the podcast say, my notes are in my head.
That works out perfectly.
I know.
My notes work
my notes
in my
are
head.
In my head.
They're all in my head. I was down there under for 3 days in the dark.
In the dark.
All right. Well, with that, we're going to move on to favorite scenes in the movie. So what's your first one?
You know what? I'm going to steer away from the action for a minute.
Go ahead.
One of my favorite scenes is actually Mason meeting his daughter. You know, this is one of those things, like, I think is I know I've heard some people argue that that scene could be taken out of the movie and it doesn't change anything of the movie, and I kind of disagree with that.
Yeah,
I mean, in a sense, it doesn't change the story at all. Mason still would have gone to Alcatraz. He still done what he would have done to rescue everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like not only does it add a little bit extra to the story because now Mason has a reason to go through with this mission. He's to do it to protection of his daughter. But it adds a little bit of depth to Mason's character.
Yeah, he wants connection with his daughter at that point.
And you can tell, like, this is something he's wanted for a very long time but never thought he'd have the opportunity to have.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that he puts on one of the greatest chases in a movie ever.
Yeah.
You know, a chase action sequence in a movie ever to accomplish this. And then once he's done, like, you know, the police show up along with, like, Stanley calls in the authorities. They show up. He doesn't try and run again, which he very easily could have done.
Yeah.
He sits there in wait because he accomplished his goal. This was the one thing he never thought he'd have the opportunity to do.
Yeah, yeah. That I placed that amongst one of my favorites, too, because he actually has that sit down with his daughter. But Stanley actually is compassionate to John at that point and gives him that opportunity. And then he steps in, but he's like, what the fuck? And it just, like, they slapped the handcuffs on him. But at least he gave him that moment with his daughter, who's very respectful. And I thought that was very good.
Let's cut the chit-chat, a-hole.
Exactly. That's the exact line. But the thing is, it shows a lot of respect for... It's like the beginning of the respect for both of them at that point, you think.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely it is. you know, it's that's one of the things that kind of leads to this connection between these two characters.
Oh yeah,
and I think it kind of also stems from the fact of Stanley finding out he's going to be a father.
Yeah, dad himself, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So I think like. And that's another thing I've heard people say, like, why was Carla pregnant? Like, why did they do that? Like, she could have just been a girlfriend. She didn't have to be pregnant. No, the pregnancy kind of added to the situation.
It played to the actual story.
It played to why Stanley was willing to
do everything that he needed to do.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
To not make him look like a criminal in front of his daughter who he's just meeting for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, there's every element of this story has a meaning. And
exactly.
Yes, you could have taken some of them out and it wouldn't have changed the movie. But I think it adds to it. It adds to it.
It definitely does. My first one would be, well, Stanley taking care of that particular package that shows up at the office.
Hi, Stanley.
And yeah, exactly how he kept his nerves of steel within that event. He was so determined to get that deactivated while the gas was eating his suit as well as his partner's, and he refuses to use the atropine. And it's like it's something that's ongoing throughout within the film because he refuses to stick that needle in his chest. But the fact that it shows his conviction now.
Yeah, it does. And to be fair, in Stanley's defense, that atropine would have stopped nothing.
Oh yeah.
It is a useless when it comes to melting skin.
It won't do anything.
Atrophine does jack
does
shit.
Does nothing. Yeah, exactly. So don't think that, everybody. If there's something that's flesh-eating virus and they give you atrophine, no. Don't
take it. You're just, like, it's, don't
You'll
take
just be
atrophine.
Living as you're eating away.
Yeah. Don't take the atrophine. Kiss your ass goodbye.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the atrophine, I mean, it's a movie trope. But, atrophine would have done nothing. It would have done absolutely nothing.
Exactly. Your next one?
I'm skipping around a lot. Your scenes are kind of seem to be going in order of the film. But
Slightly.
Again, I'm going off the top of my head. So I'm skipping around a lot. I'm jumping closer to the end of the movie this time.
Good.
The scene with Hummel.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, God, for the life of me. It's Hummel. And Baxter, and it's the scene where you literally find out that Hummel is not truly the bad guy in this movie.
So you're talking about like Tony Todd and those
Fry and
people.
Fry and Darrow, yes,
yeah, okay.
Where Fry and Darrow turn on Hummel. That is an incredibly tense scene.
Oh, it is, because he demands and he states, "We are mercenaries. We are not Marines anymore."
Yeah, mercenaries get paid. I want my fucking money.
Exactly.
You know, but it's a tense scene because, especially mm-hmm. with Major Baxter, because you don't know where he stands yet at this point.
Yes.
And then, you know, he points the gun at Hummel and says, like they said, Frank, it's over. But then you get that quick change where he fires at Fry and Darrow.
Exactly. He shows his compassion. He shows his loyalty to Hummel. Yeah.
And this is also the end of Hummel and Baxter.
Yeah, exactly.
And what I like about this scene, other than the tension, because it is a very tense scene,
mm-hmm.
you know, with Goodspeed and Mason kind of just watching from the shadows, watching waiting to see how it's going to play out,
mm-hmm.
Which was the right move, because why take on four when you only have to take on two? Unfortunately, they got the two most insane fuckers to deal with afterwards.
Afterwards, yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, let's see who wins, and then you're still a loser because you have to deal with the winners. But at the same time, like, this is a big redemption moment for Hummel.
Exactly.
Like, he's doing something that's very obviously wrong. Mm-hmm. Like, taking hostages, threatening the country with this VX poison gas attack. He's doing something that's very obviously wrong, but when you listen to his reasoning why,
mm-hmm.
he has good intentions, but with wrong actions. And then this is the moment where it's kind of a redemptive moment for him, because he realizes, oh, shit, what am I doing wrong? Like,
he realized,
why am I doing this?
Everything. Yeah. And at that point, then he gives Stanley the information that he needs.
Yes. Yeah. Which I kind of laugh at because, you know, Stanley's asking him, where's the last rocket? Where's the last rocket? Lower lighthouse. And then the last rocket is fired to kill Captain Darrow. But yet Captain Fry is still wants the chip back.
Yeah.
Why? There's no rocket to use in it.
Exactly. That was the confusing part of the whole damn movie.
I just don't think Fry
also
knew.
Why did he take the chip out? If you notice at the very end, he takes a chip out of something, and I'm like, wait, there's no more rockets at this point.
What yeah, I know. It's kind of a little bit of a nitpicky or continuity error.
Yeah. Was it bad editing?
He asks him, like, where's the last rocket? Lower lighthouse. Well, he used it to kill, Tony Todd's character.
Yep.
So there's technically
no rocket
left. So yeah. Why do you need to take the chip out?
Yeah, exactly.
The chip is useless at this point. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
so...
that was a problem I had with the movie, too, because after watching it, I think this is probably maybe the 15th or 13th, 15th, who knows how many times I watched this, and I saw that, and I was like, what's with that stupid chip?
It's pointless. Like, I mean, I could see Captain Fry still chasing Stanley because he believes there's still a rocket in play. Mm-hmm. He wants the chip back. But why did Stanley take the chip? Like, that's what I just don't get.
And, well, speaking about certain scenes and how intense they are, similar to that one, I know that Hans Zimmer did the composing for the movie.
Yes, he did.
There were hints of Pirates of the Caribbean within that score. From what I could hear consistently, there's so much influencing, the pounding, the jumping. If you listen to the score, you'll hear it in certain scenes.
I think you might want to reverse that, like, and say that Pirates of the Caribbean score was influenced by The Rock.
Probably, yeah,
because The Rock came before.
Yeah, I know.
Pirates of the Caribbean.
But I'm just saying, I think it influenced into Pirates of the Caribbean. Like you're saying,
I wouldn't disagree with that at all. I mean, a lot of composers, like, I've listened to so many movie scores
and similar themes that,
and yeah, they all tend to use similar themes. Like, I can hear a score and say, "Oh, that's John Williams," or I can hear a score and say, Danny Elfman is very obvious when you listen to Danny Elfman music, but yeah, I can hear it and be like, "Oh, that's Danny Elfman,"
yeah,
or "Oh, that's Hans Zimmer," or "Oh, that's anybody." Like, I've listened to enough scores that I can do that. So I have no doubt that you heard.
Oh, yeah.
The Rock in Pirates of the Caribbean.
I did.
It could work the other way around because the influences were already there.
Yeah.
The similarities are there.
And it's the pumping and the driving, if you listen to the music, too. Mm-hmm. So it's very similar. But you knew that moved its way into Pirates of the Caribbean when you actually get to those movies.
Yeah.
So I thought that was pretty cool. Because you saw a progression, because I think this was Hans Zimmer's, like, first few movies, I think.
During that time? I'm trying to think. It was very early on in the popularity of Hans Zimmer.
In his career.
He's done, God, so many movies. But I'm looking here at some of the movies he had done before. He did Twister.
Mm-hmm.
Broken Arrow was another big action movie that he did before.
Yep, Travolta.
Which is another movie you need to cover on this podcast.
Yes, I know. Yeah.
Backdraft was another one that he worked on. Driving Miss Daisy. Castaway, but that's a different Castaway because that's 1986.
Yeah.
So it looks like the first big movie he did, composing-wise, was White Fang back in 1991.
Hmm.
And then he did some music arranging and producing for a little bit. But he did composing. It looks like the first big movie he did, like I said, was White Fang back in 1991. And then it looks like Broken Arrow was another big one. Muppet Treasure Island, Twister, and The Rock were like... And Face Off, which is another movie I know you and I are going to talk about.
Yeah, exactly.
Gladiator, Mission Impossible. Yeah, he's done a bunch.
He's been moving on since then, obviously. So, yeah, it kind of, like, pushed his career, I think, as with an action, an adventure.
Yeah, I have no doubt about that.
Well, you know, actually, no. We have to say that, the Muppet movie, Treasure Island. Yeah, that's what did it.
Hey, it got him Pirates of the Caribbean.
Exactly.
So you may have said that as a joke, but I honestly think there's some truth to that.
There's got to be.
I think there's actually some truth in that.
He choreographed Muppet, Tim Curry.
Muppet Treasure Island got him to Pirates of the Caribbean.
Exactly.
Who do we know has done a pirate movie before? Well, it was the Muppets, but how about Hans Zimmer? Done. Okay.
Done. All right. Well, your next one?
I'm glad you brought up the score, because I love the score to this movie. And okay. One of my favorite tracks on this movie is that chase. You know, that starts in the hotel.
Yes. With Stanley. The haircut scene.
Yep.
Yep.
Are you happy with your haircut? You know, with Stanley chasing him through the hotel into the Hummer and the Ferrari chase throughout San Francisco. That is, I used to listen to that soundtrack a lot when, because I owned it on CD. And I used to listen to it a lot. And anytime that track came on, I always pictured that chase scene and it always made me drive fast. That was like one of my pedal to the metal songs in my car.
Now it's Baby Driver.
No, now it's now it's Shoot the Thrill by AC/DC.
Well, everybody loves Shoot the Thrill. Come on.
That's like Shoot the Thrill is like my, when I hear that, I'm like, oh shit. Tighten the seatbelt. Hope there's no cops behind me because I'm moving.
I think Iron Man and there's another one. Shoot 'em up.
No, I'll tell you where I got, I know we're kind of getting off topic, but I'll tell you where I got Shoot the Thrill became my driving song was Dukes of Hazzard.
Really?
With Sean William Scott and Johnny Knoxville.
Yes, yes.
Because I will still argue to this day, as bad as that movie was, that is one of the best cinematic car chases I have seen in a movie in a long time.
Well, yeah, well, listeners, if you want, just go back, watch The Dukes of Hazzard with Sean Everett Scott. And
Sean William Scott.
Sean William Scott. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And Johnny Knoxville. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he gives him that look and he just turns the wheel and just keeps his eye on him and the song just goes and his eyeballs just bulge.
Yeah. Cause it's Flirting with Disaster by Molly Hatchet when the chase scene first starts.
Yes.
And then there's that moment when they realize that Johnny Knoxville fooled around with the girl that he has.
He's got that fear in his look and his face.
Look at the road, Bo. Look at the road.
And he's just looking at him.
And it goes into Shoot the Thrill into, like I said, one of the most awesome car chases through the streets of Atlanta that I have seen in a long time. But anyway.
Yeah, another movie by MC Gainey, by the way, too, by the way.
Yes, it is. Well, not by him, but with him.
With him, yeah.
But I digress, and I go back to The Rock. I'm a sucker for great car chases
in
movies. And The Rock is another one. Like, that chase, like, it gave us a huge piece of action, like, cinematic action, before we even got to the main meat of this movie. Because the main meat of this movie is Alcatraz.
Yes.
So this movie, like, it's almost like Michael Bay and Bruckheimer and Don Simpson were sitting around reading a script. And we're like, you know what? Like, it's 40 minutes into this movie. We haven't gotten to Alcatraz yet. We got to give them something.
Yeah. And what better than to give them a car chase in San Francisco that's all hilly and crazy.
Mm-hmm. It's all downhill.
It's all downhill. And trust me, I've driven through San Francisco.
Not the movie, the chase is all downhill.
Yes, yeah, but I'm just saying, but even still, I drove through San Francisco, and it's all down, up and downhill. Not fun. Yeah.
I've never been to San Francisco, but I can't imagine, like, driving up those streets.
Oh, I've walked it, too. It's not fun.
No.
But the fact is, it's like, seeing that, and I could see them making those jumps, wow, amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's, don't get me wrong, like I said, I have issues with Michael Bay, but Michael Bay can pull off some good action.
Yes, he can.
It's just,
I admit that.
Explosions are filler for him.
Well, it's kind of like an Emmerich thing, too.
Yeah, but Emmerich kind of, like, I think Emmerich has logistical reasons for the explosions that he puts in. Michael Bay, I think, just says, like, this needs an explosion.
Blow it up.
Blow it up. That kid just fell off his skateboard, Michael.
Blow it up.
Blow up the skateboard. What? Blow up the skateboard. You heard me. Blow up the skateboard.
Put a M80 underneath the skateboard and light it up.
Michael, there's no logistical reason or realistic reason that skateboard would have blown up. He had cherry bombs underneath. Blow it up.
There you go. It's Gleaming the Cube, part 3.
It was a gas-powered skateboard. No, it wasn't, Michael. I don't care. Make it a gas-powered skateboard. Blow it up.
Wait. Christian Slater was the father in Gleaming the Cube, part 3, and he blew up the skateboard?
Oh, I don't know. I'm still talking about The Rock.
I'm just joking.
I mean, I love that chase scene. There are so many continuity mistakes.
Oh, I know that.
In that chase scene, Stanley Goodspeed crashes into parking meters that shatter the windshield. But in the next scene, windshield's fine.
Yeah, I know.
It's absolutely fine.
I know.
It's
hilarious.
The Hummer tears through a Volkswagen like it's aluminum foil. No, that would not happen because a Volkswagen is made of metal. It's not a DeLorean. It's made of actually metal. A Hummer is not going to peel through it like a tin can like that.
Exactly.
Because you know that Volkswagen was emptied out. Like, there were no seats or anything in it so that the Hummer could drive through it.
Yeah.
There's so many continuity mistakes, but again, I love that scene. It's so good.
All right. So that was your last one, or did we diverge so much?
That was my next one. That was my next favorite scene.
Okay. My next one would be the scene when Stanley is calling Carla to stay away from San Francisco due to the events that were happening. And then Mason barks at him after he states, it's a need-to-know basis. And he doesn't need to know. You don't need to know.
Roar!
Yeah.
Careful, he bites.
Exactly.
That scene, I'm sorry, Stanley. Why are you marrying this woman? Like, to hell I'm not going. Your boyfriend / fiance is an FBI agent. If he tells you not to come to San Francisco, fucking listen to him.
I know, right?
Why are you marrying this woman?
Apparently he has to hide his Beatles paraphernalia from her after spending $600 on the White Album.
Right? Okay, so yes, you knocked this girl up. That is a situation that you are in. But she doesn't listen to your advice, and you have to hide your hobbies from her. Why are you marrying this woman?
Especially since he's playing there's a guitar on a guitar stand that is worth over $1,500, and he's playing one that's well worth over $800.
I have issues with that scene.
I know. Same here.
But I let it go because I love the movie.
Yeah.
So I guess that leads to my next one.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the cistern. Because that is a badass scene.
Okay.
I've seen Escape from Alcatraz with Clint Eastwood. Mm-hmm. And I've seen some of the shit, because Escape from Alcatraz is actually based on a true story.
Yes, it is.
This, very obviously not.
Nope.
but having seen, Escape from Alcatraz and seeing documentaries on things that people had to go through to get out of Alcatraz, actually, like being in the tunnels in the dark at night, like that shit was kind of realistic when he mentioned underground in the dark. Like, yes, people who have escaped Alcatraz before, which there aren't many, have recounted stories that they had to do that. Yes. Because I mean, it's still theorized that no one has ever escaped Alcatraz. But people have gotten out of Alcatraz. They might have just not survived the escape from the island itself.
Exactly.
But the shit that they made up with him timing, rolling through the cistern. If you didn't already know that John Mason was a badass at that point, that confirmed it. Like, it's like, okay. who the hell is this guy?
Exactly.
And, like, why are you not giving him a fucking gun? Because he's more badass than any one of those soldiers that he is with.
What did he state to Ed Harris when he goes, "Oh, who are you, sir? Where did you come from?" And he goes, "I worked for Her Majesty's Secret Service." Kind of like that, but not Secret Service.
Well, I mean, and he even confirmed it to Stanley that he was British intelligence.
Exactly.
You know, and I think with the exception of...
So basically he just told him, yeah, I'm James Bond.
Yeah. He was basically James Bond in this movie.
Literally. Old-ass James Bond that was in prison for years.
Yeah. He was a British spy. He worked for the Queen. Yeah. That's fucking James Bond.
Yes.
Like... You know, and he tells, like, with the only person who really knew who John was Womack.
And his daughter.
Well, no. I don't even think his daughter knew he worked for British
intelligence. His daughter only knew rumors and lies, and that was about it. Yeah, you're right. Womack was the only one. Yeah.
Womack was the only one that knew that John was British intelligence until he told Stanley.
Yeah.
Because that Stanley was need to know at that point.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know, so like, but you are absolutely 110 fucking percent right. John Mason was James Bond.
Yeah.
Just retired because he had been locked up.
And he had long hair and had that grunge look.
Grunge.
What's grunge? You have to be a teenager in Seattle. Oh, okay.
It's a grunge thing. Grunge. I'm just gonna quote Sean Connery for the rest of this podcast. But that was mine. I love that cistern shit. Like, that was the moment that I remember the first time I watched that movie in theaters. The moment he goes rolling through that cistern and avoids it, and then comes out on the other side, open the door, and welcome to the Rock.
Rock.
I'm like, this dude's a badass.
Exactly. It's like, yeah. You've already made your statement. You are the badass.
Yep.
Yeah, you are the person who trained the Highlander. Yeah, okay, we got it. Okay.
He trained the Highlander.
All right. Well, my next one, well, it's one of my most favorite, which would be the standoff within the showers once the Marines got in. And that was just so intense, that standoff between Michael Biehn and Ed Harris, and shouting, that whole shouting match. But the whole firefight alone, and how many guys got killed within it, the screams of Ed Harris and Michael Biehn just ring through my head throughout the whole time.
Well, it legitimately takes out everybody.
Yeah.
But Stanley and Mason.
Exactly.
You know, again, this is another scene there that I have issues with. Well, not have issues with, because I love the scene. It's very tense, like you said.
Yeah.
But there are some big...
Oh, with the cameras and everything?
Continuity issues in this. First off, there is no upper level to the showers in Alcatraz.
Yeah, I know that.
It's completely made up for the movie.
Yeah, it is.
Second off, this is a high security maximum...
Security prison. Yeah.
Why are there manholes in the shower? There are no drains that big in any prison shower.
They're all small little things.
Yes. Because you want to prevent people from escaping.
Exactly.
So the fact that there's a manhole-sized drain in Alcatraz's shower, this is not Alcatraz.
Yeah, but nonetheless, the scene was incredible, and because it was just see that firefight and the standoff. But like you said, yeah, the manholes. Yeah.
I mean, again, like that was another that's another very glaring, realistic movie goof.
Yeah, it was
in this movie. But I mean, again, the scene is so good that you kind of overlook it.
You overlook it for the fact of pure entertainment at that point.
Yeah.
And that's the whole point of this.
Yeah, exactly.
Your next one?
I'm going to talk about the sewers.
Okay.
This is another one of my favorite scenes because this is a pivotal scene for Stanley.
Okay.
Stanley is an FBI agent, but he's a chemical freak, yes. A chemical super freak, actually. But he's never seen, combat.
Combat, yeah.
And this is Stanley's first kill. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's saving Mason.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very pivotal scene for Stanley because this is literally what's going to set the rest of Stanley's character in motion for the rest of this movie. Because up until this point, Stanley was very timid.
Yeah, he was.
It's not until he gets his first kill, rightfully so. It's not like he murdered a guy in cold blood. You know, he does it defending Mason.
Exactly.
This is the point that's kind of the switch that flips for Stanley, and Stanley becomes kind of a badass.
Yeah, this is by the time of the morgue scene at that point, right?
I think this is right. Yes.
All right, yeah. Well, that would be my next up when Mason and Goodspeed are in the morgue. Stanley winds up taking over as being like, I'm the specialist. I'm the one that knows what I'm doing. Hey, don't touch that.
Yeah.
Is that a regular thing? The foot twitching? Yeah, the foot twitching. Can you stop that? He goes, no, it just happens. And it's just like, well, and he goes, here, hold this. Oh, he goes, don't jiggle it. It's like, it's like Stanley just taking control because that's his element. And it's kind of like him being in that scene where he was disassembling the bomb at that point, you know? Yeah. So it was like, and then I think then Mason starts to respect him and what he knows and what he can do. So I think that was a really cool scene in a sense.
Well, because, I mean, it's in that moment that Stanley showed some authority.
Exactly.
You know, he stood up to Mason.
Mm-hmm.
Mason has been the badass the whole time. He's been the one that kind of took over. But you're right. Like, this is a moment where Stanley is in his element. This is what Stanley's good at.
Mm-hmm.
So Stanley took charge. And I think Mason kind of respected that.
Yeah. And they show respect at the very end of the movie, too, as yeah. we'll go into.
Yeah, exactly.
Another one?
Let's talk about the prison escape. Where Mason reveals how he got out in the first place.
The rope and throw.
trade secrets, my boy. I mean, this is after they've kind of been captured by Hummel and his men, and they're locked up inside. And
exactly.
You know, Stanley has pretty much given up all hope. He thinks hope is gone, and they're not going to get out.
Yep.
And, you know, in the middle of the conversation, like, they start talking about John's escape and how he got out and how in Zeus's butthole did you get your cell open? I only ask because it might prove pertinent in this situation. Maybe. And then the cage opens.
Because he used tied up bed sheets to roll and throw something to release a lever.
I'm not going to talk about how unrealistic that is, and it would not happen.
I know.
But it's still cool as shit.
It is. It is cool as shit. It's like a Goonies thing.
Yes. that is not how physics work.
No, it doesn't.
So let's put aside the fact that that trick would not have opened the cage, but it was still a cool little thing to see them do.
I think it was something that somebody wrote in the writer's room when they were high on weed and decided, hey, let's put this in here because that's cool as shit.
Mark, let's be honest. This was the mid-90s. It was Coke.
Okay, fine. Coke.
So, oh no, that no mid-90s was probably transitioning to weed. It probably could have been weed.
Yeah, it was interweaving.
Coke was more like the 80s into the late 80s.
And into the 90s. People still smoke weed in the 90s, so. Yeah,
exactly. But yeah, I thought that was cool. Like, again, like, it was confirmation that John Mason is a badass.
Yeah. Yeah, he is.
Even though it's unrealistic, he's still a badass.
He is. He's 007.
That's right. He's James fucking Bond.
All right. Well, my last one would be the scene at the end when Stanley shoves the VX nerve agent orb into the guy's mouth. And shoves it so much that it breaks open. But then Stanley actually has to use that needle of atropine to go into his heart, which he stated he would never, ever use. And then he lights the flares to signal to the fighters that are just happening to show up at that moment to bomb the island.
Yeah. With napalm, which they said at the beginning of the movie that VX poison gas was built resistant to napalm. Again, napalm
that they didn't really test properly. Yeah.
Maybe another glaring movie continuity mistake there.
I think so.
But still, we overlook it.
Exactly.
And again, Stanley taking atropine, which would have done nothing to help that situation.
But keep him living longer to enjoy purgatory of being burned alive.
Would have turned him into Ghost Rider.
Exactly. Oh, wait, he already did that movie.
I know. Would have turned him into Ghost Rider earlier.
Exactly.
I love, too, one of the other things, and I don't really have any other scenes, too. That was kind of, that the ending was kind of my final one as well, and you just touched on it.
Yeah.
But I love the fact, too, one of the other things about the VX poison gas, because I've looked into it. Like, I've looked into, like, is VX real, and how serious is it?
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, I've tickled my throat. First off, it's not green. VX poison gas, I think, is yellow when it's actually... I think it's yellow. I know it's not green. I know it's not green.
Gaseous mode or, you know, liquid. Yeah.
When ingested or if it opens up, it actually takes a couple hours to take effect. It's not an immediate response.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't burn the skin. So atropine would have worked on actual VX poison gas because it doesn't turn your skin melty.
Okay.
But it takes, again, like 1 to 2 hours, and then before it starts to take effect, and then it's kind of your body starts to convulse. If VX poison gas is rendered aerosol, like they were trying to do, the effects are immediate. But the breaking of the capsule wouldn't have been aerosol. It would have just been released immediate. So it would have taken some time for it before it affected them. But one of the things I like that the movie does, and when I say like, I'm saying jokingly, in the beginning of the movie, when we see them first take the string of pearls or the rockets with it, and it breaks open, mm-hmm. and one hits the ground and it rolls.
Mm-hmm.
When it rolls, it is, and even later in the movie at the end, when it's rolling, you hear a glass rolling on concrete sound.
Correct, yeah.
But in the beginning of the movie, when it hits the wall, it's a gel. It's not glass.
Yeah, I know.
So gel does not make a glass
sound.
Sound rolling on concrete. It doesn't make any sound at all.
Yeah, I know.
So, I mean, I get where the sound editors were coming from. Like, okay, we need to put something here.
Which also leads to the last line that he says, glass or plastic? Glass or plastic? Think about it.
That doesn't have anything to do with.
But I think that was the one thing I was thinking about with the whole, the actual virus itself in those globes. I'm thinking glass or plastic.
Glass or plastic?
That's what I was thinking too.
Like, okay, like which one is it in? Because
hey, Nick, let us know.
In the beginning, it breaks open like plastic, but it rolls around like glass. Like, I don't know, like, which one is it? I don't know.
Exactly.
But, yeah, I mean, there's some definite...
Continuity issues.
Continuities. But, again...
Entertaining.
I love this movie for what it is. I don't care. I'm only bringing up continuity issues for the sake of this podcast.
Oh, I know that.
Otherwise, I don't give a shit.
It's really fun. It's just fun to watch, in my opinion.
It is.
That's really what it boils down to.
Yeah, start to finish, I love this movie.
All right, well, with that, we're going to move on to interesting facts or unknown facts about the movie. So I'll start off with the first one, which would be number 10. Well, it was an unlikely premiere, so since The Rock was filmed predominantly on Alcatraz Island, it was only fitting that it play a prominent role in the premiere once production had finished. For the sake of a little fun, the prison's recreation yard was used as the ideal spot for the film's first premiere showing?
Recreation.
Recreation.
Not Recreation.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the
Alcatraz is one of the most iconic shooting locations in movie history and has been used to film not only The Rock, but Clint Eastwood classic, like you stated before, Ben, Escape from Alcatraz in 1979, Point Blank in 1967, and Murder in the First in 1995. And Murder in the First was, I believe it centered around Alcatraz itself.
I don't remember Murder in the First. For some reason, I'm thinking Wesley Snipes, but I don't think that's right.
I don't think that's right either. I think that had to do with the movie about the guy who escaped from Alcatraz.
Murder in the First. Yeah, let's see. That was well, that's the TV series. I don't want that. Murder in the First. Christian Slater, Kevin Bacon, and Gary Oldman. I don't think I've ever seen this.
Yeah, I think I saw it way back when, but I just forgot about it.
Yeah, and it does. It takes place at Alcatraz.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's an Alcatraz prisoner.
All right.
And Michael Bay is also really well known for doing those extravagant movie premieres.
Oh, definitely. He does all these things that show highlights and everything within it. So if they did a Godzilla movie, they're going to do it in Tokyo.
Well, I mean, and that's like, and like Pearl Harbor was done on one of the aircraft carriers that actually fought in Pearl Harbor.
Pearl Harbor, exactly.
And it was at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii.
Yeah.
Because I actually know two people who went to that premiere.
Wow.
And they said it was one of the most incredible things they ever attended. Yeah. So, but yeah, he's known for that kind of thing. So having the movie premiere at Alcatraz does not surprise me at all. And honestly, I think that would be kind of cool.
Yeah.
I've never been, and I would love to go one day.
That would be amazing.
Yeah. I guess number 9 of interesting facts, an antagonist with real influences. Ed Harris portrayed the noble yet angry, fed-up General Hummel, who was actually based on a real person, at least in part. According to producer Don Simpson, the memoirs of Colonel David H. Hackworth played a major influence when he came up with the Hummel character. Hackworth was extremely upset at the U.S. handling the Vietnam War and the soldiers that fought in it. Simpson also took inspiration from a 60 Minutes interview detailing the disavowing of covert op soldiers on foreign missions and the anger it would create in the United States' most elite officers. Hmm. That's cool. I didn't know that.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
As we read these things, we are learning things as you guys are.
That's so awesome, though. I love that.
I love this idea. So, number 8. Connery had Bay's back, so apparently Sean Connery was notorious for sticking his nose in the production process and pointing out inefficiencies in the shooting process, but that was a testament to the dedication towards his craft. When push came to shove, Connery would go to bat for his crew, something director Michael Bay would, you know, attest to. Tensions flared between studio execs and Bay over the way the shooting process was being held, and he was called into a meeting which Sean Connery asked to be a part of. Once they both arrived, Connery stood up for Bay and put the execs in their place by telling them what a good job he was doing.
Hey, man, Connery's got the cred to do that.
He's got the cojones. He must have wore a kilt because he's going to show his cojones if he does that.
Well, but I mean, like, you know, like, again, you're talking to James fucking Bond.
Bond.
At this point.
Like, yeah.
Connery's got the clout in his career to know if somebody's doing something right or something wrong.
Yeah.
If Connery speaks up at this point in his career and says Bay's doing a good job, you listen.
He has a legendary name at that point in the 90s.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, everybody
Connery
knows
was a household name at this point.
Exactly, and if you had him on your crew, he was somebody to be listened to.
Yeah, you listen. Number 7, an accidental obituary. Producer Don Simpson died during the film's production due to a massive cocktail of illicit and illegal drugs in his system. Along with Jerry Bruckheimer, Simpson was one part of a titanic duo that created some of the most memorable and successful films in Hollywood. Yeah, I forgot that this was his final movie that he worked on.
Yes, you and I both covered this when we covered Con Air.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about this briefly. Actually, at the very end of the movie, there's a dedication to Don Simpson, if you watch it.
At the end of Con Air?
No, at the end of this.
I don't think so, because I just watched the end of it today, actually, and I don't think there's a dedication.
Unless there was a Blu-ray rip that I had.
Maybe.
or a copy, but they have a dedication to Dom Sisson.
Okay. It would make sense if this is the movie he passed away during.
Yeah.
I mean, and I know, like, Don Simpson, Jerry Bruckheimer, the logo with the lightning bolt showed up in...
That was them.
...in further movies after after Simpson had died.
Yes.
But I think that's mainly because those were movies that were put into production before he had died.
Exactly.
So they just hadn't been completed until after his death.
Yep. All right, well, number six, Michael Biehn's typecasting. Well, action movie star Michael Biehn is best known to audiences for a string of films where he plays a military man or another kind of action hero. His portrayal of Navy SEAL in The Rock is a direct parallel of his performance in the 1990 action flick Navy SEALs, not to mention others. Biehn played future war soldier Kyle Reese in The Terminator 1984, and Colonel Marine Corporal in Aliens 1986, and of course, Navy SEAL in the underrated 1989 sci-fi classic, The Abyss, which Diana and I covered. So, yeah, Michael Biehn's been pretty much typecasted pretty much as military, if you think about it, within film.
Yeah.
Except for The Mandalorian.
But even, but even in The Mandalorian, he was a soldier.
Yeah, he was.
So he's definitely been... I think the only movie I've ever seen him in where he wasn't typecast was Take Me Home Tonight.
Yes.
Which was the movie that takes place in the 80s. And I think like he plays, I think, Topher Grace's father in that movie. So he's not typecast as a soldier in that movie.
Yep.
But I love one of my favorite things about that.
Oh, yeah. Bring it up. I know that you're going into
the music video for the song. Oh, God. What's the song? I love it. It's a cover of You Were Working as a Waitress in a Cocktail Bar. Oh, God. What did the hell
Take
is the
Me Home
of that
Tonight.
Song?
Come on.
No. No, that's not. Is it?
Yeah.
Is that
Don't
the
You
the
Want
song?
Me, Baby?
Take... Yes, okay, it is Take Me Home Tonight. Jesus Christ. I love that cover, too, and I don't know why I forgot it. But there's, in that video, the cast of the movie are recreating classic 80s scenes.
Yeah.
And in one scene, Dan Fogler recreates the Terminator scene,
yep.
And the camera turns around and pans, and Michael Biehn is just standing there, and he's waving at the camera. I'm like, that's fucking brilliant. Like, that's so good.
Yeah, so check that out. Take Me Home Tonight is actually a good movie, too. I enjoyed that. That's fun to watch.
Yeah. Oh, God, and yeah, I can't. That's just, it's so good.
All right, well, number five.
Oh, it's my turn. Sorry. Number five, a ruined stunt. Former Navy SEAL and Hollywood action movie consultant Harry Humphries. I know Harry Humphries. Showed up on set one day during filming to witness a man on fire while being suspended in the air. Without missing a beat, Humphries' training took over and he grabbed the nearest fire extinguisher to put him out. Unfortunately, Humphries didn't realize that a stunt was in the process of being filmed, and he had just ruined the take without realizing it. Director Michael Bay yelled out from the sideline, "It's the movies, man." It makes me think of that scene from, I think it's Lethal Weapon 3, when Riggs sees somebody being held up.
Yes.
And decides to jump in and take the guy out, and not realizing it's the...
Danny Glover's daughter in a movie, and he's trying to protect her. Yeah.
Not realizing it's a scene from a movie, and... Yeah, and he ends up ruining the take, so...
that's pretty cool.
That's fun.
Well, number four, frightened onlookers. So some of the scenes shot took place in a real locales for maximum effect. Regardless of innocent bystanders were watching from the sidelines, the Fairmont Hotel in San Francisco was used to stage one exciting scene where FBI agent or director Womack is tossed off a balcony and left to dangle. This led to a series of frightened onlookers who didn't realize the film was being shot and instead thought that something nefarious was taking place. They phoned into the hotel and most likely the police to blow the whistle.
That's awesome.
Yeah. For the fact it's like, oh my God, that guy's hanging from the ceiling. Oh, let's call the police. And then
somebody help that guy.
It's okay. It's only the movies.
Yeah, exactly. God, that's so good. Sorry, I was looking at something. I got distracted. I'll look at it later. Anyway, so number three, a challenge taken. Mm-hmm. Nicolas Cage epitomized the need for people to ignore their naysayers and shoot for their dreams, regardless of what they may be. According to legend, many people working within Hollywood told the actor that he didn't have what it took to pull off a role under a big budget action blockbuster. Rather than relent and accept their criticism as fact, Cage viewed their remarks as a challenge and decided to go for it. His success in The Rock might have been the necessary catalyst to go for Broken Con Air, which debuted 1 year later.
Nope.
That's cool.
That is cool. So it gave him a push to do something more extreme, which is really cool. And got him out of like those particular character roles that he was doing before, if you think about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and don't get me wrong. Like, he was... And by the way, this is what I was looking up. The name of the song is not Take Me Home Tonight. It's Don't You Want Me, Baby.
Ah, okay.
And it's by the band Atomic Tom.
There you go.
The reason why I was bringing that up is because I want your listeners to go check that out and check out the video.
All right, cool.
It's Atomic Tom, Don't You Want Me, Baby, and it's an amazing cover.
So, all right.
Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, listeners, check that out. That's awesome. So number two, Connery's Odd Demands. Okay, this is going to be interesting. Most big shot Hollywood actors demand everything from 24/7 limo service to an obscene cut of the film's proceeds. But Sean Connery had other considerations in mind. He hated the idea of traveling by ferry every day and night to get to and from the shooting location on Alcatraz. So he made a different kind of demand.
What is it?
I don't have that.
What's the different demand? You don't have it listed.
I don't have it listed. I didn't get it. So I'm assuming helicopter?
I don't know if there's a helicopter. Well, I mean, a prison yard is big enough to land a chopper. So maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe he just stayed at Alcatraz.
Well, that'd be interesting.
Now there's mystery involved, Mark.
Ah, yeah, everybody go out. Look, that's homework.
What demand did he make? Now I want to know. Damn it. Way to ruin my night, jerk. Leads us to number one, Cage's character input. Nicolas Cage portrayed the goofy but lovable Stanley Goodspeed in The Rock, and he was responsible for injecting the character with many of his trademark mannerisms. Mm-hmm. Originally, Goodspeed was supposed to have some varied character dialogue, but Cage wanted to play him more like a straight arrow. Mm. He was the only one who convinced Michael Bay to allow his character to refrain from using profanity throughout the film. I noticed that.
Same here.
A-hole! Throughout the film in favor of far less menacing language. It was another nod to his unlikely hero persona that ended up making the final act so exciting to watch. Mm. Yeah, he doesn't curse at all in the movie.
No, he doesn't.
He uses a-hole, butthole. It's just fun.
Yeah. I think that was a nice transition for him, though. But then he changed that.
Yeah. But I like when I hear that actors have a say.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's not always the case.
No, it's not. Yeah, they probably gave him carte blanche at that point because now he was the lead. So they probably said, hey, what do you want? Okay. We'll try to do that.
Yeah. Oh, man. I think this brings us to the part I was looking forward to the most.
All right, well... Well, here we are. We're going to go to quotes. So what's your first one?
Which one do I want to go to first?
Exactly.
Well, it's certainly more enjoyable than my average day. Reading philosophy, avoiding gang rape in the washroom, though it's less of a problem these days. Maybe I'm losing my sex appeal. That line always makes me laugh every time.
Oh, that is true.
I love it.
My next one will be Stanley Goodspeed saying, I love pressure. I eat it for breakfast.
Your best. Losers always whine about their best. Winners go home and fuck the prom queen. Carla was the prom queen. Really?
Exactly. I know. I left that for you, dude.
Glad you did. gave me an opportunity to do a horrible Sean Connery impression.
Well, this is one for Mason, too, saying, The Rock become a tourist attraction?
The Rock has become a tourist attraction? Listen, I think we got off on the wrong foot. Stanley Goodspeed, FBI. Let's talk music. Do you like the Elton John song Rocket Man? I don't like soft-ass shit. Oh, no, no, no. You I only bring it up because it's you. You're the Rocket Man. Fire away!
And Tony Todd just goes into the air with a rocket.
Yes.
The next one would be from Goodspeed himself saying, Honey, you want to know who really killed JFK? And that's after they get the film from the right front right pew of that church.
From, Fort Walton, Kansas.
Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah, he gave him the exact directions, too.
This one I'm only saying because it's just another chance to do a Sean Connery impression. Womack, why am I not surprised, you piece of shit?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, especially the look on his face, too, when he cuts the whole round, but regardless of him cutting it, he still has to smash it open with his elbow. Yeah. It doesn't make a hole. It just smashes this... The mirror anyway.
Well, I mean, he uses the quarter, you know, to kind of like score it. Yeah. You said that, and I don't know why I repeated it. I don't know.
It's funny, though. The last one I would have would be Mason himself saying, Patriotism is the virtue of the vicious, according to Oscar Wilde. And that's showing that Mason is a poet and didn't know it, apparently. Plus, he has a clear head on his shoulder as to what he was doing after his incarceration. And he sees what Hummel was doing as a little bit too crazy.
Well, I mean, when we first meet Mason and they're taking him out of his prison cell, if you look at some of the books he's reading, like he's reading The Art of War. And
exactly.
He's reading some serious philosophical shit.
Yeah.
And then it's after he says that, Hummel punches him in the face. And he's like, thank you for proving my point.
Exactly.
Look, I'm just a biochemist. Most of the time I work in a little glass jar and lead a very uneventful life. I drive a Volvo, a beige one. But what I'm dealing with here is one of the most deadliest substances the Earth has ever known. So what do you say you cut me some frickin' slack?
Exactly. He didn't even say fucking. He said frickin'.
He said frickin'. Yep.
Yeah, that's all I had for quotes. Do you have any more? I'm pretty sure you do.
I have two other ones. Okay. I don't want to know nothing. I never saw you throw that gentleman off the balcony. All I care about is, are you happy with your haircut?
Yeah.
And then right before that is, I can't cut anyone's balls off with a trimmer now, can I? I'm only borrowing your Humvee.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm one of those fortunate people who like my job, sir. Got my first chemistry set when I was 7, blew my eyebrows off. We never saw the cat again. Been doing it ever since.
They have, like, so many good one-liners in this.
This movie is so quotable. And that'll be my last one because it's I can keep going if I want to do, but I won't.
And if you all want to hear those, go watch the movie again.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. I have one more.
Do it.
I have one more. What kind of fucked up tour is this?
All
That's
right.
it. I'm done with my quotes. Now you know why I was looking forward to that part of the podcast.
Oh, I know you did. All right. Well, with that, what we do in this podcast every time, we rate this movie out of 1 out of 10 on adrenaline scale. So what was your rating, Ben?
So, like I said, I set the bar, the benchmark with Die Hard.
Yes.
Die Hard for me is basically the 10 out of 10.
Okay.
That being said, I'm giving The Rock a 9.2.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. It's like I said, if Die Hard wasn't the benchmark, The Rock would be. So it's high up. There are mistakes. There are continuity errors. There are realistic errors. I don't care. I just adore this movie. I love it so much.
Yeah, I don't feel as extreme as you do, so I'm going with an 8.5 out of 10. But I do enjoy the movie. So, honestly, it's passable, and it's something that I always watch. But I it's not my extreme go-to all time.
No, that's fine. I mean, that's not for everybody, you know?
Yeah, I know. I know, but it is the Cage threesome that I have to do every time I watch movies that has Nicolas Cage in it.
And I'm going to be able to do all three of them on this podcast with you.
Exactly. And I just watched Face Off. I just watched Face Off yesterday. So it's like, and I'm like, oh my God, we still have to do this movie.
I'm fine with it.
No, I'm fine with it too, but I was just like, I started watching, go like, wow, we still have to do this. This is going to be fun.
Yeah.
Because not only was this quotable, so was Face Off.
Peach. I could suck a peach for hours. Why am I doing Connery? That's not Connery. I put the Connery, I said hours. That's
hours.
Connery. Connery's not in that movie. Why am I doing that? I don't know.
All right. Well, with that, we move on to, well, guilty pleasure movies. So any action movies or any movie that are not popular or great, but you just love to watch every time and just like to watch because regardless of whatever anybody else thinks.
So it's over to me for this?
Yeah.
Okay. I made sure I came prepared this time.
Okay.
With my guilty pleasure.
Do it.
My guilty pleasure this time around is a little gem starring or featuring rather.
Okay.
I'm going to see if I can get you to guess what the movie is when I read off some of the cast.
Oh, no.
So the cast includes Tommy Lee Jones, Frank Langella, Phil Hartman, Ernest Borgnine,
Jay Moore,
Kirsten Dunst, Dennis Leary, David Cross. I'm running out of bigger names. Sarah Michelle Gellar, Michael McKean.
Wow.
Christina Ricci, the late great Dick Miller. Have you not figured it out yet?
No.
Christopher Guest. Okay, let me read you some of the character names and see if you can figure it out.
I'm not going to figure this one out.
Alan Abernathy. Phil Fimple. Chip Hazard.
Oh, my God.
That should have given it away.
Oh, my God.
It's Small Soldiers.
As soon as you said Chip Hazard.
Yep. Major Chip Hazard.
Sarah Michelle Gellar?
She does the voice of the Barbies.
Holy shit.
Most of the names I read off are voice talent.
Yeah, I know.
Tommy Lee Jones, Frank Langella. Well, Phil Hartman's in the movie.
He's in it, yeah.
But Tommy Lee Jones, Frank Langella, Ernest Borgnine, Christopher Guest, Michael McKean, like they're the voice talent.
Oh my God. Movie.
Everything else is just a toy.
Oh, wow.
The movie is so bad. I will watch it whenever I get an opportunity. If I'm flipping through channels, which I rarely do anymore, and I see it on, I'll watch it.
Yeah.
If I'm flipping through my library looking for something to watch, and I come across Small Soldiers,
you gotta watch it.
That's what I'll watch. It's the definition of a guilty pleasure.
Yeah,
it's a horrible movie, but I love watching it.
Oh yes. Wow, that's amazing. It's funny because I don't even think of that as a guilty pleasure movie. It's really sad. But, well, mine will be something we already mentioned in the very beginning.
Oh, let me take a wild guess what it is.
It's new.
Go ahead.
Just came out. Willy's Wonderland in 2021.
Which I still need to watch. I do want to watch it.
It just came out, ladies and gentlemen, and you guys have to watch it because it does have Nicolas Cage. But the cool thing about this movie, Nicolas Cage doesn't say one word.
He doesn't say a word.
At all in the movie. And there's a reason behind that, and here's the reason behind that. The producer/director and writer wrote this in the sense of he was going to have to be the lead character. Then he brought it up to one of the other producers and people that were going to promote the movie. And they said, well, you need a lead character. Okay. So they sent it out to Nicolas Cage's publicist and manager. Cage got it Friday evening, said yes on a Monday morning, and he was booked to be the character. He didn't want any changes to the script. So he didn't have to say a damn thing. All he had to do was act. So to me...
And we all know Nicolas Cage can do that.
And it was hilarious for the fact that this movie kind of gives that those tropes of like 1980s horror films, as well as like the Banana Splits that came out not too many years ago.
Five Nights at Freddy's, which is a popular video game.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it has all those elements and feels to it, and it just works perfectly. Now, if you go to Willy's Wonderland merchandise.com, you cannot get the shirt for Willy's Wonderland at all. It's sold out.
Of course it is.
And nobody could get a copy of that shirt. You could probably find a knockoff on Redbubble, but...
And they might restock eventually, too.
They will, too, yeah.
They probably didn't think there would be such a call for the shirt.
Yeah, and the movie just literally came out in the beginning of February, I think.
Yeah.
So
I mean, there was a lot of underground buzz about this movie before it came out. Like, the moment the trailer released...
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure the production company was thinking, like, okay, this is just another goofy Nicolas Cage movie that we're going to put out. You know, it's probably pretty low budget. And then the trailer hit, and everybody was talking about it.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm sure, like, merchandise-wise, they were not expecting the demand.
Yeah, merchandise overload.
Yeah.
But it's fun to actually go see. So watch it if you can. I watched it a good three times already, so...
I'm already committed to watching The Martian tonight, because I've been itching to rewatch that for...
Oh, I know.
Ever since the Mars rover landed the other day, I'm like, I really want to rewatch The Martian. So I'm already committed to doing that tonight, but possibly tomorrow I might finally take a swing at Willy's Wonderland.
Yeah, well, the fact that I convinced somebody after just talking about it and they never heard of it and giving them the premise, and at the very end I said... Nicolas Cage is the lead. They were like, all right.
Done.
This sounds like it's really, really bad or really bad good. So after the weekend, Jason, who I work with, said, dude, that's my new favorite movie. So I was like, okay, all right. So I convinced somebody. And then he had to convince somebody else. And the other person said, Willy's Wonderland. It sounds like a gay porn. And I'm like,
that's surprisingly accurate.
I'm like, okay, but and then he goes, yeah. And then I mentioned Nicolas Cage was in it, and then Jason's friend was like, yeah, I gotta watch it. I'm like, good, do it. And then
you know what Willy's Wonderland sounds like, and I know you'll get this reference.
Yeah.
I just brought up Dick Miller earlier when I mentioned Small Soldiers. Yeah. Willy's Wonderland looks like the bar that Willy goes to in Demon Knight.
Yes, it does.
Which was played by Dick Miller.
Yes.
Have yourself a cold one, Willie.
Exactly. But if you guys are going to actually watch that movie, get your energy drinks all set, play your pinball games, and get your knife ready. So just watch that movie if you can.
Nice.
So that's my guilty pleasure movie this week. So with that, we're going to move on to, where can listeners hear you, Ben?
So the easiest place to find me is thenextlevelnetwork.com. That's where you can find links to all of the podcasts that are on that network, including your panels, The Pixels, which I am co-hosting with you for the next couple weeks to talk about WandaVision.
Yep.
I did two episodes with you, and by the time this comes out, we might already be onto the third or past it. I don't know, because I don't know when this is releasing.
Oh, this will be out in another day or two.
Okay. Well, then, so yeah, we'll be two episodes in, gearing up for the third.
Yep.
But of course, I have We Have to Go Back Lost Revisited podcast with our friend Kristen, which is on the network.
Yep.
My Spotlight with Ben Beck podcast, which is my celebrity interview podcast, which is gearing up for season 7. Seven seasons. I'm so excited that I've made it that far. And then my Wilhelm podcast, which is another movie-related podcast, which is the RSS feed is created. Mm-hmm. The first preview show has been recorded and uploaded. So That will hopefully be releasing within the next day or two, and then we'll be recording the actual podcast hopefully starting next week. So you should see them posting up sometime in the next couple weeks. Those episodes will finally be releasing. And that's the one I want to push more than anything else right now. So I will say, other than nextlevelnetwork.com, I will say facebook.com/thewilhelmpodcast, mm-hmm. Twitter and Instagram @thewilhelmpod, and thewilhelmpodcast.com, which will basically send you to the Next Level Network page for the Wilhelm Podcast. And you can start subscribing now, actually, on, or within the next couple days, on Apple, Google, Stitcher, Amazon, Spotify. Like, it'll be on all of them. So just look for a podcast called Wilhelm, and you'll find it.
All right. Cool. So just like Ben stated, I can be found on Panels to Pixels on the nextlevelnetwork.com. That's where Steve and I do our podcast for Panels to Pixels, and we cover all movies that are adapted from, and shows that are adapted from comic books, and we just have a good time. Right now, Ben and I are covering WandaVision, and he's going to be on there until the end of the season. Steve is still doing Snowpiercer with Daphne and maybe other guests, so you could listen to each and every individual episodes, because they're individual episodes when it comes to that. So
yeah, I like the fact that you guys split them up.
I split that up specifically just to give time for each episode, so it made more sense. So that way Steve takes hold of that on Snowpiercer, and I take hold of WandaVision. Mm-hmm. So I just have fun with it, and it gives equal length to each episode that we're covering. So I think it's fun, and I think everybody else will have fun. And eventually we'll all come back together, and we'll be doing something else.
One happy family. You'll be back together for the Snyder Cut.
Yeah, that might be a mess. But we'll probably cover it nonetheless.
We'll be covering a 4-hour waste of time.
Is it going to be four hours?
It's 4 hours.
Oh. Maybe we'll just do a brief synopsis.
5-minute discussion on a 4-hour-long movie.
Exactly. All right. Well, with that, if you guys want to submit your feedback, you can just go to our Facebook group, which would be facebook.com/AdrenalineCinemaPodcast. Well, we could also be heard on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, Deezer, or whatever podcast player choice that you're using. If there are ratings there, and you're able to give a rating, please give us a rating or promotion if you can. Podcasts come out each week, so just put them out whenever you can. And we do actually put our what we're covering on each podcast on our Facebook page. So leave the comments below of the picture that we're going to be covering the movie next. So I did, however, put John Wick that was going to be next. Cat's not ready because apparently there's filming going on at the farm that she lives at. So she's
goat
having,
man.
Yeah, goat man. Some six nippled guy is taking over her farm where she stays. So,
and that's just the actor.
Exactly. And the film crew.
That's not even the monster.
So we're going to be covering John Wick 2 eventually. I will be posting something about Red Dawn with Wendy that she and I will be covering, Red Dawn from 1984. So look out for that image, and then just leave your comments below on that, or just send your email to us as well. You could just type out an email at adrenalinecinemapodcast@gmail.com, or just record yourself like, you know, Steve does, and just record your voice and your voice feedback and send it as an attachment, and we'll play it live. I'm surprised we didn't get a message from Steve this week.
I was kind of waiting. I was half expecting there to be a voicemail from Steve.
Same here. Yeah, but I never got one. But you could always do that, and we'll play it live, and we'll comment and just give you an idea of what your thoughts were on the actual movie. So with that, I'm Mark.
I'm Ben.
And this was Adrenaline Cinema Podcast, and I just want to thank everybody for listening, and thank Ben for being here.
Yay!
Awesome. Well, we'll all talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye.